This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Bill Littlefield has tackled sports from every literary angle, as a commentator, a columnist, an essayist, a novelist, and now as a poet. In his latest book, Take Me Out, Littlefield uses poetic verse to cover all sorts of games, from football to baseball, chess to roller derby. You probably know Bill Littlefield as the host of NPR's Only a Game, heard every Saturday morning right here on NHPR. And Bill will be speaking and signing copies of Take Me Out this Saturday at the Toadstool Bookshops in Milford and Peterborough. And Bill Littlefield, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with your poem about Olympians. They may not be giants. Could you read that one for us?
Sure. It won't take very long.
Well, we picked it for a reason.
That's good. They might not be giants. Olympians need not be giants. They need not be tall. The female gymnasts at the games are sometimes kind of small.
So this is a great one. And one reason I really enjoyed it is that, you know, of course, you've written poems here about mainstream sports like baseball and football, but you've got a lot of off the beaten path sports as well. Was it hard to compose poems about gymnastics or squash or croquet?
No, it was challenging. And it was fun. There was really nothing, no labor involved in this. It was just fun. And that has distinguished it from every other book I've written. The others were hard work. This was fun.
Do you feel like you really know enough about every sport to compose a poem, or did you have to do any research?
Very little research, because doggerel, the kind of poetry that I write, really doesn't lend itself very much to research. No, it was just, you know, kind of goofy stuff. Squash is a vegetable as well as a game, so I had some fun with that, you know, that sort of thing.
As I was looking over the poems, I realized that I could only think of a couple poems, aside from your book, about sports, Casey at the Bat being the only one that I think people might recognize. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is, that we don't see so much poetry about sports?
Well, I think there is actually a fair amount of poetry about sports. Homer wrote about boxing, and he wasn't too bad a poet. So, you know, we can go all the way up to that. And Donald Hall up there in New Hampshire writing about Ted Williams not so very long ago. So it's out there. You have to kind of look for it, but it's out there.
You've got to weed through the romance.
Yeah, yeah, and the cliches that generally constitute sports writing.
Well, you know, speaking of cliches, I think that a lot of us are led to believe that literature and a love of sports are sort of diametrically opposed. But do you think that's the case, or do you think sports are really good fodder for literature?
Oh, I think historically sports have been spectacularly good fodder for literature. I can name numbers of writers and novels and short story writers who have made all sorts of good use of sports. The one I was thinking about earlier today was Mark Harris, who wrote Bang the Drum Slowly and the whole series of wonderful Henry Wiggin novels. You can go all the way back to Damon Runyon and the brilliant stuff that he wrote that passed as sports writing, but really it was literature. And I've had the opportunity over the years to read a great deal of it. W.C. Hinds, Bill Hinds, who a brilliant, brilliant writer, and to the great benefit of sports, he wrote about sports.
And then, of course, there's folks like Charlie Pierce, who we hear on the show every week.
There is Charlie Pierce, who not only writes brilliantly about sports, but talks brilliantly about sports, at least on a weekly basis.
So what makes it good writing? I wouldn't think it would necessarily be the sport as subject, but the subject as a vehicle?
Well, sometimes the subject really does lend itself to good writing because There's suspense built into most athletic competitions and character. You see what happens to players who fail and what happens to players who succeed. And, of course, an athletic career is a kind of short version of a life where you're old in baseball terms. For example, by the time you're in your mid-30s, late 30s at the latest, you may have half your life still to lead, but you're an old man in terms of your legs not being quite as good as they used to be and your eye not being as sharp. So you get that kind of compressed version of what it's like to live a life acted out in front of thousands or millions of people.
Yeah, and then there's the underdog stories and I suppose the scandals too, like Armstrong.
Altogether too many of them. But yeah. Yes, you're right. They're all human interest stories, and they all take place in the context of games.
Do you find that certain sports make for better narrative arcs than others? I mean, we were talking about this. We couldn't think of a single novel that, featured a tennis player so much as we could think of so many baseball ones.
Well, Martina Navratilova wrote, or at least allegedly wrote, a couple of mystery novels that were set in tennis. But I'm not sure how good they were. I didn't read them. But you're right. Some sports probably lend themselves to great storytelling. Baseball certainly has going for it the incredible amount of history and the statistics and the myths and the way you can go to a ball game and see a young player and say, well, gee, you know, that guy reminds me a little bit of fill in the blank with your favorite shortstop or center fielder. So there is that kind of background that's available to anybody who is inclined to write about it. And drama is built in, as I say, to pretty much all sports where competition is involved.
In fact, you wrote a novel about baseball called Prospect.
Prospect was born in part out of my acquaintance with a guy who'd been a major league scout for many years. And I met him and I was fascinated by him. It was a guy named Lenny Marullo who played shortstop for the Cubs back in the 40s and then made a long career as a major league scout when his playing career was over. And he just had so many stories about guys that he had scouted. And the more I looked, the more stories there were. And I thought, well, this would be a scout would be a great narrator for a novel because anytime I ran out of a gas in terms of moving the plot forward, I'd just have him tell another baseball story and that would take up several pages. And it worked out pretty well.
Do you think, speaking of those off the beaten path sports, that we're likely to see a great American novel about gymnastics anytime soon?
Anything is available, you know, a good writer who's fascinated by something and enthusiastic about it and can bring energy to the task. The subject really is secondary, I think.
Today, we are seeing more and more in-depth coverage of sports. I'm thinking of ESPN's documentary series 30 for 30, mm-hmm. Websites like Grantland. Do you think we're entering a golden age of sports writing and journalism?
That's an excellent question. We're certainly entering an age where a lot of what used to be called journalism is appearing in places other than newspapers or magazines, that's for sure. And some of it is terrific. All you have to do is look at Houghton Mifflin's annual collection of best American sports writing, and you see that more and more of it is coming from blogs or websites, and it's spectacularly good.
Bill Littlefield is the host of NPR's Only a Game and author of several books, including his latest, Take Me Out. It's a collection of illustrated poetry. And Bill, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Bill will be speaking and signing copies of Take Me Out this Saturday at Toadstool Bookshop in Milford and Peterborough. You'll find details on both events on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And Bill, before we go, is there a specific poem from the collection that you'd like to read? Another one?
Since you mentioned sports that are a little bit out of the mainstream, how about one on polo? Is that all right?
Polo sounds perfect.
Okay, here we go. There is this game called polo. It's a splendid game, of course. You swing a mallet at a ball while riding on a horse. You ride upon the horse, I mean. The ball is on the ground, and when you whack the ball, it makes a very pleasing sound, a kind of thwack, I guess you'd say, much deeper than a click. And doing all this on a horse is quite a clever trick. I'm sure the people playing polo have a lot of fun. The horses? I don't really know. I've never questioned one.
You can get your chance to hear more from Bill Littlefield. There's information at wordofmouthradio.org. Bill, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Clap your hands! Stomp your feet!
While most sports journalism focuses on professional athletes, sometimes it's the stories about amateurs that inspire the not-so-athletically gifted among us. Reporter Allison Quantz brings us one such story about a man who started running when he was 43 years old. And now, nearly 20 years later, he's achieved a pretty impressive feat. He's run a marathon in every state.
Each marathon has its own special. You name a state, and I'll tell you something special about that marathon. Alaska was the first one I did in the journey because I figured if I could make that work, I'd owe myself Hawaii at the end.
Francis Bush, an econ professor at the Virginia Military Institute, was never an athlete. He didn't really play sports or run or anything until age 43. And even now, 50-some marathons later, Bush still doesn't consider himself an athlete. You've never heard anyone make marathons sound so warm and fuzzy.
There's two sides to running. I am a runner. I'm not a racer. I enjoy the thrill of just doing the distance. Spending time, I say prayers, I listen to music, I meet people, and I see places.
You might be skeptical of this I don't care how fast I go attitude. And it's true, Bush's fastest time, 4 hours and 31 minutes in Charlotte, North Carolina, is pretty impressive. But his slowest marathon?
Leadville, Colorado took over 8 hours. And we had to run, well, climb from 11,000 to 13,000 feet in 3 miles. I couldn't go 2.5 minutes before I'd have to literally stop and breathe. And then you keep going because you want it.
In Kona, Hawaii, Bush ran for 6 miles on a lava flow.
Hot, very hot, because it's straight sun. It's a plain tropical sun. My whole head fried, even though I have a full head of hair.
The biggest lesson learned from a marathon in Wyoming? Always read the directions.
Oh, yes. There was a little line on the application that said, bring your own water cup. And so I got to the first stop and I asked for the cups. They said, we don't have any, but they had a cup to share. So I used a community cup. Got to the second stop, no cup. So I put my head underneath. Third stop, there was a discarded water bottle. Well, we do what we have to do. And so I took that.
Bush's love of marathons is so convincing, even his pregnant daughter decided to join in. When he checked the 50th state off his list, Wisconsin, his daughter also crossed the finish line in her first marathon. Because of her pregnancy, the doctor said she should drink a special electrolyte mixture at each checkpoint. So Bush sprinted just ahead to mix the drinks the way the doctor ordered.
So I'd run ahead and make her drinks and tell the, you know, my daughter's coming, she's a little blonde woman, you won't know if she's pregnant, but tell her that daddy made this drink for her, and I finished in about 6:15, and she finished in 6:27.
You name the state, he'll tell you the story. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quantz.
Not every sports victory is exactly what it seems. Up next, we'll discuss the art and history of athletic hoaxes. That's when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. Last year, as part of its 30 for 30 series, ESPN released a short documentary detailing the escapades of perhaps the most prolific sports prankster of all time, Barry Bremen. Between 1979 and 1986, Bremen was responsible for over 20 hoaxes in professional sports. Here's Bremen, along with a few former Kansas City Kings, remembering the warm-up layup line at the NBA All-Star Game.
As soon as the door opened to let the players out, I went in with them, and I joined them, and I went up to them, I'm talking to them, and I said, fellas, don't be alarmed, I'm not here to hurt you.
He was 6'5", 6'4", 6'5", I mean, he looked like an athlete.
And next thing you know, he's bricking layups, you know, bricking little shots, and high-fiving Kareem, and Otis Birdsong, and Tom Chambers, and Jack Sikma.
I couldn't believe I was out there playing with these guys, and here I'm on the floor of the stadium, and I was nervous because I'd never ever broken the law, I never did anything semi-exciting like that.
In recognition of Barry's impressive history of imposting, Brian Curtis, staff writer for Grantland, compiled a list of memorable practical jokes played in the world of sports. Virginia spoke with him about the sports hoax tradition earlier this year.
Bremen pulled off these hoaxes decades ago. Would his antics work now, you know, with 24-hour media coverage and every detail of sports figures tracked?
You would think imposting would be harder now, right, with the increased security and, as you say, the kind of digital scrutiny that all these things get. But, you know, just not so long ago, a very famous Notre Dame linebacker had a girlfriend out in somewhere on the West Coast who didn't exactly exist, right? And while that's not exactly, you know, the kind of hoax we're talking about, these things still can slip through. So I think, you know, with a determined prankster, sure, yeah, there's plenty of potential there.
What makes a great sports hoax?
I think a great sports hoax is one in which you sort of go in with a very, very specific plan and you exploit something that either the owners or the writers of the sporting world are looking for. For instance, if you want, you know, if they're looking for great stories of rookie phenoms, maybe that's how you slip in. Or maybe, you know, they're looking for sort of the old Cinderella thing, the team that comes out of nowhere. And you exploit that, and you slip right in, and, you know, you pull a fast one on everybody, I guess.
I guess that's red meat for sports writers. Give us another example of the Cinderella phenomenon.
Well, there was this Dick Enberg was one of the great sportscasters for NBC and CBS. And back in the 70s, he decided it would be really funny during his college basketball broadcast if he invented a team called the Wyoming State Porcupines. This sounds totally ridiculous, right? The Porcupines. They might have even been the Fighting Porcupines. But, you know, we watch the NCAA tournament every year. We love the Cinderellas. And so every couple of weeks at halftime, he would mention the undefeated Wyoming State Porcupines and how they were climbing up the rankings. Now, no one had ever seen this team play, and it might have been curious that they never were actually in the NCAA tournament if they were undefeated year after year after year. But he pulled it off for 2 years. And writers were calling by the end and asking, geez, you know, do you have any context over there? I'd love to do a story on the Fighting Porcupines.
Another story and another prank. The baseball world met 36-year-old Richard Pohl. What was his prank?
Richard was 36 years old, as you say, and totally washed out as a baseball player. He wasn't any good. Nobody was going to sign him. But he realized that if he had his same skill set as a 21-year-old baseball player, that maybe he would have a chance. So he fashioned himself as Rocky Perrone from Australia. And the hoax went all the way to him wearing a shaggy Pete Rose hairpiece, a Dutch boy painter's cap, and teaching himself 70s dugout chatter so that he would do it. And the really the ingenious touch of this is when he was going around and auditioning in front of scouts, he knew that no 21-year-old would know how to bunt. That was like an old man's skill. Mm-hmm. So he pretended to not know how to bunt, and that sort of did the ruse. In fact, the Padres wind up signing Rocky Perrone, as it were, and he managed to get a couple of bats in Class A ball before someone finally recognized him.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about this motivation. You talked about sort of, you know, proving that you can pull the wool over someone's eyes. But there's something deeper going on for some of these people, isn't there? There's grandiosity, or there's sort of like, I can prove it. I can play in the big leagues. What's going on in people's heads, do you think?
Right. There's wanting to belong, right? I mean, it's the old story of, you know, your great dream, maybe your only dream, is to play football or basketball or baseball or whatever it is at a high level. And you don't get there. And so you show this kind of, you know, ingeniousness and work ethic that perhaps you never actually applied to the sport when you were playing it to try to slip in, you know. And I think that is, it does speak to this, you know, condition of wanting to belong. And of all of us, you know, at some point in our childhood, at least, wanting to be professional ball players. Uh-huh. But there was a great one in Nevada a couple of years ago where a kid basically just said that he was committing to play college football, that he had gotten a scholarship from California, University of California. In fact, he'd never been offered a scholarship. And, you know, it was really, really touching because what he wanted was not to fool people so much. He really wanted that scholarship.
Mm. Another great trick, proving that you can't, if you can't fake a winning team, just fake an award. Give us this rundown at students at the College of William and Mary.
This was truly ingenious. 1972 at William & Mary, there's a number of, I think, four undergrads who see all these All-America teams coming out in the newspaper, and they're sort of amused by this. And they say, what would it take to just make up a completely phony All-America team? So they cook up an organization called the, quote, National Association of Collegiate Basketball Writers. We're giving out an award called the Hirschberger, named after a fictional New York sports writer, long deceased, of course, by the time the award comes out. They cook up phony letterhead. I really appreciated this touch. It said, serving the sport, you know, on the letterhead. This is this organization of very self-important sports writers. Anyway, they just came up with the list themselves, making sure to include a William and Mary player on the list, sent it out to all the winners, as it were, and newspapers, and it ran on the AP wire, and they maintained it for a couple of years. And one of them later went to Notre Dame and saw the Hirschberger, this phony award, hanging on the wall of the athletic department.
That is so good. 40 years this goes on. Brian, if somebody wanted to play a sports hoax, do you think that there are some sports that are easier to infiltrate than others?
Yeah, I mean, I think in that respect, college, you know, it's harder, I suppose. You know, the NFL is hyper-organized, professional, you know. I mean, I suppose you could slip on a field or slip into some minor role, but maybe, you know, that would be difficult, I think. College sports is so diffuse, right, so spread out all over the country and so run by so many fiefdoms, not just the NCAA, but the various writers giving out awards at the BCS, the various conferences, that I think that would actually be the easiest. Because, like I said, you know, like these guys figured out, you know, who actually knows what's behind any of these awards? Mm. And, you know, why not just sort of come up with one on your own? So, yeah, I think college would probably be your best bet.
Well, Brian Curtis, staff writer for Grantland, may a Hirschberger Award be somewhere in your future.
My dream would truly come true. Thank you.
That's Virginia Prescott speaking with Brian Curtis, a staff writer for Grantland, about the best sports hoaxes of all time. And the games continue on Word of Mouth. When we return, we'll take a look at the surprisingly fascinating story behind the basketball shot clock. The countdown begins after the news.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Last year, 26.3 million people tuned in to watch the NBA Finals, but basketball wasn't always as fast-paced and exciting as it is today. Roman Mars of 99% Invisible and producer Eric Mennel brings us this story about two seemingly minor tweaks that forever impacted the world of basketball.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars. There are two developments in the game design of basketball that make it so that you can stand to watch it on TV. The first is they cut a hole in the bottom of the basket. For the first 10 years of basketball, it was a closed basket, and the gameplay had to stop and the official would climb up and take the ball out of the basket every time a goal was scored. While you ponder that absurdity, I'll tell you the second, more subtle development that sped up the game and made basketball the sports juggernaut that it is today. The shot clock.
For the uninitiated, a shot clock is the smaller clock that you sometimes see counting down in the bottom corner of the TV screen.
Our reporter, Eric Mennel.
In the NBA, when a team gets the ball, they have 24 seconds to make a shot, or it's a violation, and they lose the ball.
But this hasn't always been the case. In the early 1950s, during pro basketball's infancy, there was no shot clock. Nothing forced a player to actually shoot the ball.
And if a team was winning, and they wanted to keep their lead, they could literally hold onto the ball for 10 minutes.
I mean, the game stunk. It was boring. It was stupid.
This is Dolph Shays. He's in the NBA Hall of Fame, a former player and coach whose career spanned two eras of basketball, before the inception of the shot clock and after. He says this problem of players running time off the clock by just dribbling the ball around can really be summed up in a 1950 game between the Fort Wayne Pistons and the Minneapolis Lakers.
It was a big game near the end of a season, and so the Pistons,
who were ahead,
decided to have a slowdown,
meaning run time off the clock.
Well, the game ended up 17-16.
As the final score?
Or something like that. It was in the teens.
Actually, it was 19-18. Go Pistons!
And of course, the crowd was booing. I mean, it became a real farce.
It was such a joke that in 1953, NBC decided to forego coverage of the NBA championship. They thought the game would be too boring.
Finally, it became a crisis. So basketball needed a rule change.
1954, enter Danny Bizone, owner of the Syracuse Nationals, the team Dolph Shays played for. Bizone had crunched some numbers, and he believed that some simple arithmetic could save basketball.
And Danny Bizone said, look, I have this formula. Why don't we try it out?
Bizone figured that the best games of basketball, the ideal games, had teams scoring 80 or more points each.
a score that Bizone figured was high enough to retain the audience's interest.
Right, so Bizone started tracking how many shots a team needed to make to score a requisite 80-something points.
Each team averaged 60 shots per game.
And there's two teams, that means 120 shots.
And the game was still 48 minutes long, and 48 minutes equates to 2,880 seconds.
So you divide the number of seconds in a game.
2,880.
By the number of shots.
120.
And you get.
24.
24 seconds per shot.
And to hold a player to that standard, you need a 24-second shot clock. Bizone invited a bunch of league officials to Syracuse to watch a practice game using the shot clock. Our man Dolph Schayes played in that game.
Everybody felt the 24 seconds, I mean, it was a very short period of time. So when we got the ball, I said, shoot it, shoot it, shoot it. And everybody felt, oh my God, you got to shoot it.
The entire team's sense of time had become compressed.
And the owners loved it.
Even in these practice games, there was a new sense of suspense. The owners felt it, and the players learned to love it, too. The clock became official in the 1954-55 season.
Other changes in the pro game is limiting the offensive team to 24 seconds of possession with the basketball.
Immediately, the scoring went up.
Teams scored almost 30 points more a game those next few seasons. And shortly after that, attendance jumped by 40%.
That 24-second clock, that little idea, revolutionized and saved the game of basketball.
99% Invisible was produced this week by Eric Mendel, Sam Greenspan, and me, Roman Mars. We're a project of KALW and the American Institute of Architects, San Francisco. Distributed by PRX at PRX.org.
Help guy on any penetration. Courtney Lee not able to hit, but Dwight Howard is right there.
He just pulled down the shot clock. Just what we need here is a delay. Cleveland hasn't played in 8 full days. The last thing they want is a delay here with Dwight Howard pulling down the basket and the shot clock collapsing from behind.
Stick around for more word of mouth. When we return, I'll uncover one of the most difficult exams in the world. And no, it has nothing to do with law school or med school. It is the knowledge, the test that every London cabbie has to take before he or she can get behind the wheel of a black taxi.
The long story short is you have to commit to memory all of the 25,000 streets. But not only do you have to memorize all the streets, you have to memorize everything on the streets. So that means a restaurant to literally a laundromat.
First, a quick break.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. London, England's iconic black taxis aren't just smart looking. Their drivers are known for having an encyclopedic knowledge of the city's thousands of streets, buildings, and tourist attractions. In fact, the legendary test that every London cabbie has to take before earning his or her green badge is called the knowledge, and it's arguably one of the most difficult examinations in the world. Jody Rosen is critic at large for T, that's the New York Times style magazine, and he recently wrote about the knowledge and whether this very British institution still has a place in a world with GPS and ride-sharing services like Uber. Hi, Jody.
Hi, Taylor.
So what does it take to get your green badge and become a London cabbie?
Well, you have to learn the city, and that's a bit of an understatement. What it takes is you have to pass this test, as you said, called the knowledge, which is an oral examination, which is administered in a series of stages over a period of months and years. The long story short is you have to commit to memory all of the 25,000 streets that fall within the 6-mile radius of Charing Cross, which is the kind of putative center point of modern London. So you have to memorize all the streets and how to navigate them. That is, you know, which way they run, where the kind of traffic circles are, where dead ends are, one-way streets, etc. But not only do you have to memorize all the streets, you have to memorize everything on the streets. So that means anything from a restaurant to, you know, literally a laundromat to major buildings like museums and government offices and, you know, embassies, hospitals, places of worship, et cetera, et cetera. It's an extraordinary feat to commit all this to memory, and the way that prospective cabbies, or as they're called, knowledge boys, or in some cases these days knowledge girls, go about doing this is they lease or buy motor scooters, mopeds, motorcycles, and spend often years circumnavigating the city, riding the streets, and committing to them to memory through a kind of elaborate process. Generally speaking, there's no sort of hard and fast statistics on this, but it takes most people about 4 years to do this.
Tell me a little bit about the exams. You said that you have a series of exams where you're face-to-face with an examiner. What are the kinds of details that they're asking students of the knowledge to zero in on?
Yeah, so the way it works is it's, as I say, an oral exam, and it consists of having to recite routes from point A to point B. So you go into a little examiner's room, an examination room. All the knowledge examiners are themselves taxi drivers who have, by definition, passed the knowledge at some point in their lives. It's sort of a very formal process. You're supposed to wear a suit and tie and address the examiner formally, yes, sir, no, sir.
Very British.
Very British. But they'll say, okay, take me from Emirates Stadium, that's where Arsenal, the soccer team, plays in North London, take me from there to such and such a pub. You know, so sometimes the points, as they call them, the point A and point B, can be extremely obscure. So you first have to identify the location of points A and B, okay? You have to say where the London Aquarium is and where the DNA Museum is. And then you have to name all the streets along the way. You have to recite the route along the way, naming every street and every turning as you go. And you also have to sketch the straightest line possible. So you're being judged by the examiner, not just on your ability to say, name all the streets correctly. You have to navigate efficiently.
Westminster Bridge, left York Road, right Addington Street, left Westminster Bridge Road, forward St George's Circus, lead by Borough Road, forward Harper Road, left Swan Street, County Court on the left, I think.
Think or no?
No.
I'm speaking with Jody Rosen, critic at large for the New York Times Style magazine, who recently wrote about The Knowledge. That's London's grueling taxi driver test. And he also wrote about whether it makes sense to have cabbies memorize maps in an age where you can pretty much just follow the GPS. So what's the incentive for a London cabbie to spend 4 years or more training to become a taxi driver? Do they make a lot of money?
They do make a good living. For one thing, the cost of a London taxi is the cost of a fare is forbiddingly high. There was a recent study which found that the average cost of a ride in a London black cab is about $43. And London cabbies get to keep what they earn, so they can make a good living if they put in the hours. The other thing that nearly every taxi driver will tell you is that they like the freedom, because you make your own hours, you are your own boss, you get to decide when you work, when you knock off. So often guys will work, you know, for 3 weeks straight, and then they'll take a week off.
Do you have a sense of what an average salary would be?
You know, it's all anecdotal, but I know many cabbies have told me kind of sotto voce, because they don't like to talk about this stuff, but they've kind of whispered to me that, yeah, you know, they make about what works out to about $100,000 a year. That is, guys who work real hard, who put in 12-hour days, you know, 5-6 days a week, that's what they take home. And that's, you know, that's good money, especially when you don't have to answer to anybody but yourself. And, you know, most of the people who do this are not highly educated. I mean, this isn't true across the board, but they're not highly educated. This is a blue collar profession, and that's good money for someone who's never had any higher education.
So, Jody, do you know if the ubiquity of GPS or ride sharing apps like Uber, has that been cutting into their business? Is this something that's been talked about?
It has been cutting into their business, and it's very much a concern, and has kind of roiled the industry over several years. Well, there are a couple different things that are going on. For a long time, London black cabs had a monopoly on taxi traffic in London. And then a few decades back, we saw the rise of, as they're called over there, minicabs, which are taxis that you can call up over the phone and order a cab. So the rise of the minicabs really upset traditional London taxi drivers who'd done the knowledge, because they said they're cutting into our business. The rides they're getting should rightfully be ours. And that question sort of obsessed the industry for a while, but that's been kind of, these days, surpassed by the rise of Uber, which is you know, has arrived in London over the last couple of years and has really, really significantly cut into their business. And of course, there are disputes right now in London about technically what Uber is, because what the black cab industry insists that they are operating on a meter, that their ride sharing app is effectively a meter.
An unregulated taxi cab.
An unregulated taxi cab. So there was a big, big demonstration last summer, a kind of rally, where black cabbies kind of pulled all their cabs in together and stopped in the middle of the road for about an hour to protest what they view as Uber's unregulated business practices. And then you asked about GPS also. And of course, GPS poses a big existential threat to the black cab industry and to the knowledge because, of course, you know, before the rise of GPS, it was obvious why a guy who had this specialized knowledge was at an advantage. Well, lots of people say today, if I have a GPS in my car, I'm just as good as a London cabbie.
Is that the case?
At the moment, no. Because what a London cabbie will tell you is, look, London is a very dense and dynamic terrain. It's changing all the time. There are kind of road works and construction sites that go up. Roads get closed all the time. You have to make sort of quick decisions when there's traffic or an accident. And if you're following your GPS and that's the only way around, you can't sort of take evasive action quickly. You don't. If you pick someone up in Piccadilly Circus, you've got seven different turnings and you've got a decision to make right away. You don't have time, a London cabbie would argue, to like enter an address in the little GPS on your dashboard. So at least at the moment, I would agree that the knowledge is better for the moment than a machine. And in fact, there's been some staged races between someone following the GPS and between London cabbies, and the London cabbies usually win those.
Well, but let's get to it. The truth is that you say now because you're implying that someday that will change.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the rate of technological change and refinement is such that one expects that fairly soon there will be, you know, an algorithm will be developed which will make GPS highly, highly efficient, even more efficient than a London cabbie. Maybe it'll be voice activated. Maybe we'll all be getting around using driverless Google cars. So in that sense, it does feel like the knowledge is imperiled, to say the least. And the argument that I make in the piece is that there are reasons beyond the simple efficiency why the knowledge is beautiful, you might say, and should be actively preserved. And also, it for the moment at least, is quite efficient.
Jody Rosen is critic at large for Tea, the New York Times style magazine, and he recently wrote about the knowledge, whether this very British institution still has a place in a world with GPS. Jody, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks a lot.
While London cabbies spend years studying for a chance to get behind the wheel of a black taxi, Steve Smith has spent years behind the wheel of a Seattle bus, working on a very different kind of trade. Joshua McNichols is producer and creator of the series Day Job, How Seattle Musicians Pay the Rent, and he brings us this story.
Like most drummers, Steve Smith carries around a spare set of drumsticks.
Nice little shuffle there.
He whips them out and plays a rockabilly beat on the steering wheel of the King County Metro bus he's driving today.
And then train beat. Johnny Cash.
I pulled into a truck stop out of Jackson. My rig needed diesel, my belly needed food. I filled my tanks and parked her out around back. Walked over to the cafe, grabbed a booth, an old menu. That voice was soft and sweet when it said, howdy. You're looking kind of rough, boy, been driving hard all night. I looked up from behind of that old menu. What I saw would make a felon cry. Those big brown eyes.
Steve's a driver. He drives Metro Route 76 between downtown and Wedgwood, and he's responsible for the driving beat behind a country western band called Canute Bell and the Blue Collars. He even co-hosts the rockabilly program Shake the Shack on radio station KEXP. But most of the other drivers at North Base have no idea he's a musician.
You're all wondering what I've done to deserve this. Who's this guy I think he is? Jeez, somebody special? I've been driving for 30 years. No one ever talked to me before.
North Base is like a little city.
I'll just show you around. We got
We got things to keep us amused. We have pool tables, ping pong tables. We have about the nicest base here, I think.
Ah! Any questions?
No questions. Okay,
F3. Steve joins those characters on a shuttle bus to South Base. On the way, drivers compare schedules and exchange gossip.
You think they would have gotten you something a little bit better than that?
Well, I don't want nothing better than that. That's good enough for me.
Finally, Steve gets in the driver's seat. He snakes his bus through tight city streets to reach the start of his official route.
Like right now, here we go. This is now where it starts to get busy because you got the FedEx trucks, you got people getting off of work, you got this narrow street we got to go down, and there's always going to be somebody coming right at you, I'll bet you. See? I love it when they give you the Seattle Subaru stare. They just stop and look at you like, what are you going to do? No, it's up to you. You're smaller than me. You can get around me.
Steve used to do higher-paying work. He did graphic design during the dot-com era. But the companies he worked for kept merging with other companies. Each time that happened, he lost his job. After a while, he got fed up with the instability.
If you told me 10 years ago that I'd be doing this for a living, I would have been a little bit surprised. I like the stability. It's a big part of the job. There's always going to be a need for bus drivers.
And stability is what Steve provides as a drummer. He doesn't like to show off or call attention to himself. Instead, it's all about being the backbone of the band.
And I just want to really be able to lay it down into a good rhythm section with the bass player and let the other guys kind of soar over the top.
Steve says drummers and bus drivers both need humility, and humility is one of the main messages in country western music.
I think it's a pride of doing a simple job well. You know, I mean, it's not always about climbing the ladder and making more money or something like that. It's about being content with your life in a way. I mean, even though, you know, some people might not view driving a truck or driving a bus as a very worthy profession, it's a necessary profession. I mean, someone's got to do it, and there's no reason why you can't hold your head up high and do your job well like anybody else doing whatever else they do.
That story came to us from Joshua McNichols, producer and creator of the series Day Job. Earlier this week, we talked to Silvio Pietrolongo. He's vice president of charts and data development at Billboard, about some changes that are being made to the Billboard 200. That's their week-by-week list of the country's top-selling albums.
You know, we're keeping the pure sales part intact, but we're also adding streaming activity of tracks from albums and also downloaded tracks as well.
Those changes went into effect yesterday, and while there weren't any huge shifts in the rankings, we were pretty surprised to see that 1989 returned to number one, proving that album sales still trump streaming, at least when it comes to Taylor Swift. The big winner in Billboard's new chart metric, as Silvio Pietrolongo predicted, is Ariana Grande. Her album My Everything jumped from 39th place on the Billboard 200 to number 7. Also creeping up the list from 13th place to 9th is the soundtrack to Frozen, which made the top 10 for the first time since September, proving that parents everywhere should expect to hear Let It Go at least another couple thousand times before their kids find a new obsession. Let it go, let it go, can't hold it back anymore. Let it go, let it go, turn away and slam the door. Well, that about does it for today's show. Thanks for spending some time with us. Earlier in the program, we chatted with Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game about the art of sports writing, and he provided us a list of his favorite sports books, You can check it out at wordofmouthradio.org. You might be able to find a really good Christmas present if you've got a big sports fan in the family. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth right here on New Hampshire Public Radio. Yeah, I really have heard this song a lot. Can we find something else to play?
You're as cold as ice.
Yeah, okay, that works.
You're willing to sacrifice our love.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.